This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Nixia Unleashed, Book 2 of the Nixia Triad by Scott Rankin, read for you by Sullivan Jones, with Alex Ramashaw and Carol Manda. For Mama. I fell in love with books while tucked under the covers listening to you read. Your voice built bridges to other worlds. I still find them sometimes, like majestic ruins, and can only marvel at how many ways you gave me to pursue my passions. So this world, this story, I've built it for you. Love, Scott. Part 1. The Atomites. Chapter 1. The Fallen, Emmett Atwater. Fallen angels were cast down to earth and became demons. When Babel casts us out, it's in fire and blood and steel. As the descent begins, I hold on to one truth. I am more than what they would make of me. It takes 30 seconds for the silence of space to give way as I break through Eden's atmosphere. It sounds like giant fists hammering the sides of the pod. Metal screams, and I start shouting every cuss word I know. The porthole windows dazzle. Bright purple slashes and golden hooks against black backdrops. The patterns start to turn my stomach, so I close my eyes. A snarl and a snap. Then I get a nice gut shot as the drags deploy. Flame-resistant chutes explode overhead. My velocity cuts to nothing, but my heart rate's still spiking when the entire console flashes red. I lean forward and catch a glimpse of dark nothing before the pod drives, hammer-struck, into Eden's surface.
Landing sequence complete.
I groan at the android voice. Grid lights flash from the console. They trace the contours of my body before winking out. My holographic avatar appears in the air, burns on my lower back. The cut on my shoulder from Rothi's blade is a thin red slash. There are a few speckled internal stresses, but nothing with exclamation points.
You require medical attention.
You think? Let me out of the pod.
Exodus sequence confirmed.
The porthole windows are covered in mud, but that doesn't stop the walls from peeling back like the wings of a great metallic insect. Sweat-soaked, I stagger out beneath the hatches and take my first steps on a foreign planet. Turn and search. Turn and search. I'm alone. My launch pod flashes red beacon lights, but I see no answer on the dark horizon. Behind me are vague, mountain-like rises. Ahead, a strangled valley, thick with trees and creeks. I look up, blink, and look again. Two moons loom in the starless night. Their combined light creates the illusion of a bright, snowy evening. Every branch is pale-painted, every creek a whitewashed echo. I look back up. One moon is bigger and brighter. Its surface marred by a series of bloody scars. The other moon is dime to quarter of the first. Hanging in the sky, they look like a pair of mismatched eyes set in a dark, endless face. The moons watch me stumble to the nearest creek and plunge my hands in elbow deep. A rippling shiver runs up my spine and sharpens the senses. My hands shake as I wash Rothi's blood away. I scrub dark streaks from my suit, rinse my face, and try to forget the broken boys Babel wanted to bury in the stars. I left Rothi alive, but what about Bilal? The others? Shivering, I stumble back to the pod and hoist my knapsack over a shoulder. There's nothing else to do but walk, find the others. Did something go wrong with my landing? Or did Babel lie about this too? The need to see another human face dominates every thought. I can't fathom the idea of sleeping alone on an alien planet. So I climb the nearest hill, and after that, another. My strides are light and long in Eden's lower gravity. At the top of the next hill, I look back. My pod's beacon glows red, but there's still no sign of the others. I stare down at the strangled valley, brightened by both moons, and realize it's empty. The creek shuffles through the hills. A breeze clacks branches together like spears, but I don't see any animals. No birds fluttering between branches or fish leaping out of creeks. Anxious, I press on to the next hill, and the next, and the next. Finally, I reach an overlook that connects to the other valleys. They honeycomb darkly out, each of them beaconless. I have no idea where the rest of the crew might have landed, or if they landed at all. In the gloom, I look for a sign. A hole dug into a hillside, or a tree snapped by a falling spacecraft. Anything! The landscape stares back, and a fear takes shape, nestling in the darkest corner of my mind. I'm alone. Then, a flicker. Bright orange against the pale moonlight. Not a pod beacon, but a fire. It's no more than a speck, but I strain my eyes, scared to lose the sight. It flickers again, a bright flash, and then someone brandishes the torch like a flag. The movement's so human, so hopeful, that a ragged breath escapes my lungs. I'm not alone. The others are here. The way isn't easy, but I cut across the face of the valley, trying not to lose sight of the fire. I'm forced down a pair of steep hills and into the forest. I splash my way through ankle-deep creeks and finally plunge through the low branches. They're waiting. Four faces washed in flame. Morning stands apart. She's holding a crude and crooked branch tipped with fire. I don't know who she expected, but the sight of me dismisses some dark fear. There's something fierce about the way she tosses the branch back onto the pile and crosses the distance. I can barely get my hands out as she wraps me in a hug, head pressed to my chest like it belongs there. Over her shoulder, though, I get my first good look at the others. They look like the survivors of an apocalypse, not explorers knocking on the door of a new world. Azima's eyes are dark. She's wearing her ceremonial bracelet for the first time in months, and I understand why. Out here, anything that feels like home is a good thing. Jamie rests his head in her lap. I almost confuse it for something romantic, until I see the wound. An angry red marks him from rib to gut. It's already stitched up, but that doesn't make it look any less nightmarish. His pale knuckles are painted with dried blood. My heart breaks. For him, for whoever they made him fight. The sight puts an end to my theory that Jamie was ever special or different. Babel's broken him just like the rest of us. My mind jumps to Bilal. Is my friend alive or dead? Was he put in Jamie's lunch room? Anton sits nearby too. The little Russian's eyes look completely lost. What did Babel do to us? Morning slides out of my grasp. She takes a deep and steadying breath, like for 1 second she was breathing me instead of air, before turning back to the others. "We should get moving," she announces. "Our supply location is nearby." "Moving?" Azima asks quietly. "Look at our boys. We need rest. We need sleep." Morning considers that. "Does anyone feel like sleeping?" Anton looks up. "I can't sleep. Not now." Morning's eyes flick to me. "Can you sleep? After what happened?" I realize she knows. She knows what Babel did, what they wanted us to do. If I close my eyes, I can still see Rothi on the other side of my barrier, begging to go down to Eden. It takes about 2 seconds to figure out how she might know.
You?
I ask, stunned. They made you fight? Her expression hardens. My question just confirms her guess. Now she knows what Babel tried to do to me, to them.
No, she says. I didn't have to fight. It was in the captain's instructions. The computer told me to monitor my team. It said that some of you experienced additional testing. After Anton landed, he told me what happened.
My laugh is harsh and short. Additional testing. That's what they called it? Morning nods.
I'm sorry. None of you should have ever had to go through that.
There's silence. A crackle of flame. Deeper silence. I ask,
so we just keep moving?
Morning nods again.
The walk will tire us out. No point sitting here if we can't sleep.
Babel's instructions say the supply center is by far the safest place to be. The other crews will be heading to the same center from their landing sites. I want us to get a secure location as soon as possible. But let's get things straight. All we have is each other. Babel's up there plotting. The Atomites will have their own plans. Starting right now, we depend on each other. We fight for each other. Everyone got that?
There are nods all around. But no one gets to their feet.
Jamie pinches his eyes shut in pain. His perfect hair is slicked back with water. Azima gently rubs his shoulder like that will help. Only Anton looks up. His expression slanted and dark in spite of the firelight.
We need to get all our shit out on the table now, he says. I don't want grudges.
Wind slashes through the valley. Our circle grows cold with his words.
I killed Bilal,
he says. There's only shame in his voice, but blood still pulses in my neck and through my arms and up my throat. I don't remember moving, but Morning has me by one arm. Azim is up too, holding me by the other. I'm dragging the two of them slowly forward. Anton stares back, eyes dead stone, face colorless.
I didn't want to kill him. He was in the room, waiting there. They didn't even tell me. He did, though. He said they were going to let him go to Eden if he killed me. Babel wanted us to prove ourselves one last time.
Tears streak down Anton's face, pooling along the rim of his Nixian mask.
I wanted him to at least fight me. Just fight me. I shouted at him. I pushed him. He just sat there. Refused to do it. He stepped to the side and told me to go. I didn't know what else to do. I went. The room vacuumed after.
I sink to my knees. My whole body trembles. Azima loosens her grip, but Morning holds on. And thank God she does, because I almost collapse into the flames. I want to rage. I want to hate. But Anton? The broken boy who was forced to kill my friend? He's a sword in the hands of Bilal's true killers. He's nothing. I remember Isadora's final look. The hatred that burned its way from her pod to mine. I realize she must think that I killed Rothi. But I didn't. And Anton didn't really kill Bilal. It was Babel. It always comes back to Babel.
Rothi, I say. They tried to make me kill Rothi.
Tried?
Morning asks. I used Nixia to seal him in the room and launched. Anton's eyes snap up.
God help me, why didn't I think of that?
I don't have any answers. All I can do is look away. Morning's hand tightens on my shoulder. I hear Azima hiss a string of curses. Everyone looks at Jamie next. The bloody knuckles and the gut wound are their own answers to the question. But he still says the name,
Brett. I killed Brett.
I always thought something about Jamie was wrong, that he was Babel's favorite for some reason. I started to realize that was a lie on Genesis 11. The photograph of his family, the way Jamie acted toward me. I couldn't keep seeing him as wrong. Babel is just confirming that truth. He wasn't spared. No one was. The Adamites think Babel is sending a group of innocent children. They couldn't be more wrong. Anton stands. I want to hate him, but it feels useless. How can I honor Belial through hate? The boy who refused to kill for what he wanted. The boy who is better than us, than all of us. Remember him, I whisper. Be better than they want you to be. Don't let them win. He gives a nod as he wipes the dirt and the tears from his face. He glances over at Morning. The other fight, he says, like he's realizing it for the first time. Locke and Alex. Alex would have won, Morning says. Anton shakes his head sadly.
You don't know that.
There's silence for a few seconds. Grief takes over Anton again. I remember how inseparable they were aboard the ship. I have no comfort to offer. Not with my best friend already confirmed dead. Anton lowers his eyes. It won't end there, I say. They're going to try to kill us too. They still need us, Morning replies. But yeah, after we hit their mining quotas, I'm assuming they'll try to get rid of us. We can use that knowledge against them. For now, we keep up appearances. Fathom? We mine Nixia, we earn our keep, and we always remember who Babel really is. On Genesis 12, my team had a saying, shoulder to shoulder. Shoulder to shoulder. Anton repeats. No gaps in the line, Morning explains. We stand together or not at all. The group nods their approval. I can't help asking, you have a plan? A couple. Let's get moving. I walk over and offer a hand to Jamie. He looks at it for a second, then takes it. A bloody peace offering. A reminder that we're not that different. Azima and I take turns helping him walk. If the wound was any deeper, he'd probably be dead right now. Morning leads us into the wilderness. At first she walks up front, but a few minutes in she falls back so that she's walking with me. She wears her hair in a dark braid over one shoulder. I can tell her mind is racing. The creased forehead, the restless hands, the clenched jaw. She's so tough, but the weight of all of this is threatening to bury her. We walk together, shoulders touching, like we're walking home from school on a normal day. But that's not reality. Reality is a new world. Reality is two moons hanging in the sky, bright and beckoning. Reality is what we're leaving behind as we move through an empty forest and out into a world that feels full of ghosts. Chapter 2, A New World, Emmett Atwater. As we walk, Morning slips each of us a food ration and a new gadget from Babel. She wasn't supposed to give them to us until we reached our first supply station, but she's smart enough to see that we need them. Too much time alone with our thoughts could be a bad thing right now. It helps that the scouters are a choice piece of tech. Black nanoplastic suctions to the skin, just above our Nixian language converters. The piece extends over a cheekbone and in front of one eye, ending in a tinted, transparent rectangle. I've only ever seen stuff like this in old anime shows. But there's nothing old about the scouters. A thought from my brain cycles the screen through different settings. Night vision, satellite maps, even a point-and-click database for identifying random objects in the environment around us. Our first taste of something alien comes from the surrounding forest. Azima points out that every tree has a slight lean to it. We realize it's because every single leaf is reaching out, curling in the air, grasping for the nearest moon.
That happened to mi abuelita's houseplant, Morning says, but with sunlight.
It gives the trees an imbalanced look, like they're being blown off course by a permanent western wind. Our surroundings have been so quiet that the first snap of branches sounds like a gunshot. Morning signals for our formation to tighten as the distant sounds draw closer. Her eyes look dark and serious above her Nixian mask. A huge section of the forest on our right fills with shadowed movement. Weapons out, Morning commands. Be ready for anything. Manipulations fracture the air. I pull my Nixian knuckles on. It takes about 30 seconds for the shaking branches to close on our location. I'm expecting something straight Jurassic, but the movement's coming from above. We catch glimpses of flocking, winged creatures. Their swinging limbs aren't bird-like, though. They're more like feathered monkeys, sharp-clawed and strangely limber. My scouter lands on one of them, and the word clipper pings into the corner of my vision. A thought will bring up a prepared description of them, but I'm a little busy staring as an entire pack swings overhead. Morning's the first to snap into motion. Let's keep moving.
Are you sure they're not a threat?
Jamie asks through gritted teeth. I glance over. Morning's eyes are unfocused. She's clearly reading the description I decided to skip.
It says they like shiny objects, but thankfully, they don't eat meat.
As one, we start to move. We keep our formation tight as the clippers swing overhead, clearly curious, but keeping their distance too. I watch as Morning fishes something out of one pocket. She holds up a quarter, pinched between her thumb and forefinger.
Should I give them my lucky coin?
Anton smirks.
Didn't you read the sign back there? It said no feeding the ducks.
Morning waves the coin.
But I always ignore those signs.
Before I can even make fun of her for having a lucky coin, one of the clippers comes sweeping down. I know how quick Morning is. Her reactions were godlike in our duels, but the creature is even faster. She stumbles back empty-handed as the thing bounds off with its prize. Half the pack gives chase, but the rest of them stick to following us.
Great, Anton says. Now the other ducks are hungry.
A few of the clippers grow bolder. They swing into plain sight, bearing filed teeth and beating chests and flashing bright wings. We're never in actual danger, but Azima has to hide her bracelet, and one clipper makes a swipe for Anton's watch. We're actually enjoying the distraction when one of the lead clippers lets out a hiss. The rest of the pack pauses, all dangling from branches, waiting for an order. We've reached the edge of the forest, I realize. An empty plain waits ahead. And as one, the clippers start to vanish. We watch them move back through the forest. Their departure is so quiet, I almost feel like we imagine them.
Right, Anton whispers. That's not scary as hell.
We all pause on the threshold. The waiting landscape looks just like what we saw in the mining simulations. An oppressive wall of mist in every direction. Grass-knobbed hillsides rising like graves. Little creeks darting this way and that, snake-tonguing through it all. Morning nods.
Well, we can't go over it.
Azima looks up excitedly, like she always does when she's in on a joke.
Can't go under it, she exclaims.
Have to go through it,
Jamie finishes. I smack his shoulder. You skipped a part. He shrugs.
The last part is the only part that matters.
Anton stares at us in confusion.
What is this? What are you talking about?
Going on a bear hunt,
Morning answers.
You never read that book?
Anton shakes his head.
We had more knives than books.
Morning rolls her eyes.
Great.
We'll let the one with the knives go first.
With pleasure,
Anton replies. He starts into the mist, and we follow. The deeper we go, the more otherworldly Eden becomes. Even on the rare trip to Lake Michigan, I've never seen a place so empty of anything human. The grass crunches stiffly beneath our feet. Every now and again, ash from our heavier steps puffs out like smoke. The hills boast only a few plants, and all of them have the same skyward reach as the forest, like hands folded in prayer to the distant moons. It looks like the moons have shifted in the sky, like they're on the verge of collision. I watch them for a while before realizing that quiet has snaked its way back through the group. I glance back and find Morning trailing the group silently.
Hey, you want in on a little bet? I ask, just to keep things interesting.
She cocks her head curiously.
What's the bet?
Our first alien sighting. Anton laughs from up front.
Alien sighting? Where are the aliens?
Morning notices what I notice. No one in the group has their head bowed now. Even Azima and Jamie are glancing over, wondering about the Adamites and when we'll see them and what they'll be like. It won't erase what Babel did to us, but it's a step in the right direction. She nods at me.
I'll take that bet. But you remember I don't lose, right?
She really doesn't, Anton says grumpily.
I look around, trying to involve everyone.
Any takers?
Everyone's in. Azima goes long shot, guessing it will be a full week before we see an Adamite. Anton throws his dart down on 3 days, and Jamie snags the hour window after his. Everyone laughs when I take the hour right before Anton's choice, squeezing the timing of his guess airtight. The Russian laughs loudest.
You're a pair of pisspots.
Morning goes last.
A day and a half from now, she says, early, a few hours after dawn.
The way she says the words makes them sound like prophecy. Anton reaches over and taps her scouter.
You have a captain setting, don't you? Some kind of radar for Adamites?
I don't cheat. I just win.
Anton shakes his head. My mind flashes back to Morning's score, nearly double what Longway posted aboard Genesis 11. All we knew about their crew in the beginning was what we saw on those scoreboards. It's easy sometimes to forget that they came through space on an entirely different spaceship, manned by different astronauts, with different highs and lows. Did Morning ever get put into the med unit like me? Did Anton ever feel like an outcast? How did they become such a tight-knit family? It all has me curious.
You didn't really win every competition, I say. That's not possible.
Morning throws me a raised eyebrow.
I lost a handful of times in the rabbit room. Omar beat me twice in the pit. Oh, and one time this punk tackled me off a boat and into the water.
Azima glances back.
Emmett's leap. That was amazing.
Morning winks.
Doesn't make him less of a punk.
We keep walking. Whatever spooked the Clippers hasn't made an appearance. Our maps show we're halfway across a basin that's marked by crooked creeks. I'm still not sure I could sleep, but Morning's plan is working. I'm getting tired, body worn. If I can reach a point of complete physical exhaustion, maybe my body will turn my brain off for me. I want to file the whole day under N for never again. Anton clears his throat.
Azima, I hope you won't think me forward, but you have a great deal of distracting black marks on your suit.
Azima glances back, cursing.
It's from my landing. One of the tanks busted.
Anton's mask hides his grin, but I can still hear it in his voice.
Just let me know if you need my assistance.
She strides off to the nearest creek and turns back to throw a rude gesture at Anton, before leaning down to wash the grime away. We all hear the faint, agitated moan. Before I can figure out what it is or where it's coming from, everything around Azima distorts. The air looks like a corrupted file, a ring of broken pixels. The water splashes upward, and four birds take flight. They're sleek things, no bigger than hawks, and their wings shiver black to white and back again. They were cloaking, I realize, floating invisibly on the water. Azima looks back, eyes wide and bright above her Nixian mask. We all start to laugh at her, but the laughter dies when a grating shriek sounds above us. Our eyes swing up to the birds. Their formation breaks, but before they can scatter, it comes spiraling out of the mist. A pair of massive black wings snap wide. A grotesquely human-looking body contorts, and the creature somehow snatches all four fleeing birds mid-flight. My scouter throws the name Eradicon into the corner of my vision. Wing beats stir the hip-high grass. The Eradicon hovers above, opening a gigantic beak and letting loose another deep-throated screech. I shiver as it looks down at us with all four of its eyes. Two set into an arrow-shaped head, and two center set in the rippling muscles of its chest. Eyes wide, the creature slams the first bird down its gullet, and we hear the bones crunch.
"Let's go," Morning hisses. "Nixie at the ready, Azima with Jamie."
We're all still backpedaling when the Eradicon lands. The creature's attention dances between us and its current meal, like it's considering whether or not we're worth the chase. Before we can fully turn, the landscape behind it starts to move. Dark shoulders slouch and roll. I stumble as what I thought was a hill glides with deadly grace over the plain. The name Century pings in my scouter. Moonlight avoids the creature's scaled back. It prowls behind the distracted Eradicon. I've never seen anything so big move with such terrifying silence. In old movies, creatures that size shake the ground to announce their coming. Buildings and cars get destroyed. Cities burn. The silence defies some natural law. We all watch the Century rise to its full height and descend on the distracted Eradicon. I catch a moonlit glimpse of rows and rows of teeth before the predator drags its new meal back into shadow. Dying shrieks chase us through the hills. We don't need Morning to sound the command. Basic instinct creates as much distance as possible between us and the feeding ground. I shake my head at Babel's name for this world, Eden. If this is the same mythical garden, I don't think Adam and Eve were cast out. More likely, they were eaten first. Distance eases my nerves. Morning keeps us moving at a good clip for about 30 minutes. No one tells jokes. Sweat runs down our faces. But we all know this is nothing compared to the rabbit room. In the lighter gravity, I could run for days. When Morning finally pauses, it isn't for rest. It's to listen. We each hunch down onto a knee, breathing quietly. I glance over at Jamie. He's wheezing, and his wounds ripped open a little. The blood soaking through his uniform. Azima holds a rag to the thing, trying to stop it. This isn't exactly the welcome we expected on Eden. No one speaks as Morning listens for a few minutes, then gets us moving again. We run together. We should have known Eden would be dangerous after Babel's training. The rabbit room and the pit should have prepared us. Running and fighting and fending off the wild, those weren't random tests. But I don't remember anything this big and deadly looking in the simulators. It's almost dawn. One of the two moons is starting to fade. The other one, with its bright red scars, still hangs stubbornly in the sky. Morning orders us to walk. Our pace has left us just a few kilometers south of the rendezvous point. It's hard to tell through the fog, but either a forest or a swamp separates us from the marked location. Jamie's the first one to break the silence of our heavy breathing. I think it's a good sign he's able to speak at all.
Are we really not going to talk about what happened back there? That was like live footage of a Planet Eden episode.
I have a feeling we're not at the top of this food chain, Anton adds.
Jamie nods.
That first thing looked like a dragon.
No scales, Morning says, like she's a dragon expert.
I shoot her a funny look, and she shrugs into laughter.
I don't know. I'm just saying it didn't have scales.
It didn't breathe fire either, I say. Dead giveaway.
Morning laughs. Jamie looks back long enough to make himself wince.
The other one, he grunts. The century. That was the biggest animal I've ever seen.
Anton smirks back at him.
Where are you from?
Switzerland.
The Russian wags a knowing finger.
In Russia, we're accustomed to monsters. The seas are full of leviathans. They're all twice the size of that thing, and they eat the children who behave badly.
That has Azima raising one eyebrow.
How are you still here, then?
Anton slides a knife up from his hip. Light flashes across Nixian black before he tucks it back in.
A sharp knife is a boy's best friend.
I think about the century's massive, rolling shoulders. You're going to need a bigger knife.
Ahead, sunrise breaks over the plains. Just an orange streak that blossoms and scatters the mist.
I was expecting something dramatic, but it looks like any sunrise over any forest on Earth.
As the fog clears, we get our first glimpse of the next valley. There's another forest on our left. The trees are thick, wide trunks pressed together at chaotic angles. Moss hangs between them like party lights. Our eyes are drawn beyond, though. Sunlight catches metal and glass. Buildings.
We're here, Morning says. Foundry.
Chapter 3. Foundry. Emmett Atwater. It's like Babel didn't want to be outdone. It's not enough to show us the miracle of another world. Not enough to let us witness dueling moons and deadly creatures. Babel's compound is a reminder. They intend to carve their initials on this world one way or another. A pair of towers command the rolling hills. Diamond-shaped windows spiral up the nearest and tallest building. The panes are checkered, a pattern that exchanges glass for moss all the way up. The tower has to be at least 4 stories tall. I noticed that the top of it shears diagonally. The effect makes the building look unfinished, like a false and majestic ruin. The second building is a more proper silo. It reminds me of the solar stacks on the outskirts of Detroit. A basic gray cylinder with the top carved like a massive funnel. There's clearly an underground, too. I see reinforced doors plugged into hillsides and half-buried greenhouses flanking the natural creeks. Morning's title for the place is confirmed on my scouter, as the word foundry blinks into one corner.
Hell of a supply center, I say.
Azima points.
Look how extensive the gardens are. It reminds me of Nairobi. Before I left, they started major conversions of all the skyscrapers, sustainable gardens in every nook and cranny. Politicians wanted it to be the next landscape city.
Well, Anton says, I am very proud of our employers for being so conscientious about their role in sustaining Eden's plant life. I've no doubt their intentions in making this a better world are entirely selfless.
Morning rises from a crouch.
Who's running the place?
That would be me.
The proximity of the voice makes our whole group jump. Jamie stumbles back into Azima. Anton's knife just about teleports into his right hand. Morning is even quicker. Both hatchets out as she places herself between us and the interloper. A response catches in her throat, though. She looks as shocked as we do, because the speaker is our age. A year or two older, maybe, but young. He has blonde hair, pale skin, and a few centimeters on me. The height's deceptive, though, because he looks thin enough that a good breeze might take him with it. The dark suit he's wearing displays the Babel Towers on one sleeve. He has both slender hands held up innocently, but the effect isn't helped by the pistol holstered at his hip.
Corporal Kit Gander, at your service.
He double-taps the name on his uniform, like it means anything to us.
What are you doing out here?
Morning asks.
At Foundry?
Here, Morning explains. On a foreign planet no human is supposed to be on.
Section 2 of the interstellar contract. Babel got the hookup to build 3 of these stations on the continent known as Grim Garden, which is where you landed. The contract stipulated that a Marine would be sent down to man each station.
He gestures to himself.
And you know, I actually watched the negotiations go down. It was like watching the signing of the Treaty of Versailles or something.
He frowns at Morning.
Can I lower my hands yet?
Morning glances back at us before putting away her hatchets. Kit's hands go down too, and the transformation happens in the hottest of seconds. He stumbles forward like we're all just best friends catching up after school.
Come on, there's a path this way.
We trail him uneasily. I can tell Morning still has her guard up. Probably she's trying to figure out how this kid got the jump on her. The thought makes me smile, as Kit starts flooding us with answers to questions we haven't even thought about asking yet.
I had you pinged on my radar at the kilometer barrier. I know I should have followed protocol, but I couldn't resist coming to get a look. I've been down here for a few months now, and the only person I've seen is West. He's not exactly a talker either.
West? Morning echoes. Kit nods.
West runs Myriad Station, about 200 kilometers north of here. To the northeast of him, Raheely is in charge of Ophelia Station. We didn't get to name them or anything, but I'm glad I ended up with Foundry. I always thought it sounded kind of badass.
I try not to laugh when Anton rolls his eyes back at us. Kit's too excited to notice.
You'll get to visit each station, he explains. Foundry's your first stop. We're outfitted to host 3 mining crews. You've got bunks, showers, rations, the works, really. It's home for your first leg down here. Each crew will head off to a mining site, work the day, and then rally to home base at night. I'll pack you up and ship you off to Myriad after we exhaust the area.
Morning's the first to ask the obvious question. Why'd they send you? You're kinda...
young?
Kit guesses.
And what, you're all a bunch of veterans?
That's what the contract required.
The Atomites demanded that Babel's 3 youngest employees man the stations.
Kinda like that old school ward thing that medieval kings did, you know?
If the treaty goes south, the Atomites come in and take us back to their capital, I guess. We're basically the first interstellar hostages. It's awesome!
Kit's talk carries us down the slope and toward the towers. I'm still eyeing Morning as we make our way. Clearly, she didn't expect to find someone down here, especially not someone like him. I can't get a read on what she's thinking. At least we don't have Defoe brooding over our efforts. Still, I'm kind of annoyed by Kit's presence. The more he rambles on, the more I realize he has no idea who Babel really is or what they put us through.
Kind of a space brat, I guess. Spent more time out here than on Earth, but anyway. How about you? How was your first night on Eden? A success?
We were almost eaten a few times, Anton remarks. Does that count?
Really? Is that?
He points at Jamie's wound.
Something did that?
Jamie returns a dark stare.
No, this happened during my launch sequence.
Kit frowns, before darting back to the other topic.
There are some serious preds down here. The Atomites did their best to clear the area out, but push one species out and another one comes sliding in. I knew Babel would jettison you during the best atmospheric window or whatever, but landing at night? Brutal. Everything down here hunts by moonlight.
So what'd you see? Any Everhounds?
I'm dying to catch a glimpse of one.
We saw a sentry, I answer,
an Erraticon, a pack of clippers, too. Kit shakes his head in disbelief.
Been here 4 months, and I didn't know there were sentries on this continent. You know how rare they are? Was it big?
Must have been huge.
Morning throws out a rough estimate. The rest of us are walking, stiff and silent. Anton's staring at the kid like he's from a different time period. But Jamie's hands are shaking with anger. I shoot him a quick keep-it-together look, and he just clenches his jaw even tighter. Kit's small talk is important. We need to learn as much as we can learn about Babel, and he seems like the type who will keep talking as long as there's someone with a pulse nearby. But there's still the fact that he thinks this is all fun, like this is all just a game. I thought that once, too. As the tower's entrance comes into view, Kit pulls back his right sleeve. I realize for the first time that only that hand is gloved, and that the glove is anything but normal. A white nexus is implanted in the palm. The same neurofibers Babel used for our mining simulation stretch to each finger before suctioning tight to the skin on his wrist. With a lazy backhand, he casts a digital interface into thin air. It's like a floating computer screen. The projection has a series of blue-tinted applications, tabs, and icons. We all stare as Kit double-taps a button here, shuffles an object there. Another backhand sends the display spiraling back out of existence. There's an answering grind of metal. Overhead, windows open at Kit's command. A series of solar panels to our right start to rotate. Finally, the front doors of the tower gape open. Kit lowers his hand and realizes we're all staring.
What?
He asks. It's standard tech. Didn't Babel have this on their ships? Morning nods.
They did. One day we'll stop being so surprised by it.
Understandable, Kit replies. He starts through the doors but glances back at Jamie as he goes.
All right. Let's get you down to the med bay. The other two squads are still a few hours out, so you can pick your hive first. This central space is shared by all three units. The hives are your personal space. A little pro tip. Hive 1 has the sunrise views. If you're looking for blackout sleep, though, go with Hive 3. Sun doesn't really hit until late afternoon.
Inside, the tower is almost hollow. Sunlight casts down from the windows, filling the entire structure with bright light. A pair of black staircases curl up and around the tower walls like a helix, crisscrossing to form a catwalk every 20 meters. The main floor is decorated with cushions and mismatched rugs. All the furniture is Nixian, but rough workmanship. The kind of half-form manipulations we did in early training sessions.
It's not much, Kit says, but make yourselves at home.
Jamie looks uncomfortable as he follows Kit toward the med bay. Morning slings a pack over one shoulder and marches in the direction of the first hive. She's about halfway there when she realizes none of us have budged.
What?
She asks, turning back.
No sunrises?
Anton shakes his head. Azima wags a finger.
You're my queen down here,
she admits, but sleep is still my god. Morning glances at me.
At 2, Brute?
2 words. Blackout curtains. Morning slides back our way and rolls her eyes.
Hive 3 it is.
We follow a path that takes us out of the tower, underground 20 paces, and into a connected building with gentler lighting. Half the roof and an entire wall are made of glass.
This is one of the buildings we saw,
Azima says.
I thought they were greenhouses.
The other half of the hive looks more like a bunker. Nixian walls separate rooms that could double as fallout shelters. They're arranged in a circle, honeycombing out for effect.
Like a hive, Anton remarks. So very clever, Babel.
Morning glances back the way we came. Kit's voice echoes, but it's growing distant.
Remember the plan, Morning says.
We get work done, and we keep our eyes open. I wouldn't reveal much to Kit. He seems harmless, but he's with Babel. End of story.
So anything we say to him, he'll relay to Babel?
Azima asks. Anton shakes his head.
Not just to Kit. I would assume anything you say inside this building has a chance to reach Babel, including this conversation. So let's stick to small talk until we know how things work down here.
Morning nods.
Rest first, talk later.
Anton chooses the first room, tosses his bag in one corner, and slams the door shut. Azima wanders off to explore the rest of the hive. Morning gives me a long look. The same stare she gave me the night I visited her room in space. She glances around once, making sure no one can hear us, before asking,
"Do you want to be alone?"
I shake my head. "Nah."
"Let me settle in," she says. "Just a minute."
She moves to the room on the far right. I take the room next to hers. I set my knapsack down in one corner and sit on the edge of the bunk. The room's mostly dark, with the only light leaking in from the hallway. It's the first time I've been alone since the landing, and I was too panicked then to think about anything but finding the others. Now, I have a second to wrestle with everything that's gone down. Rothi's hate chases me through space. Isadora's final look echoes, and Bilal.
Babel killed him.
Babel killed him. A dark part of me thinks that that was always the danger of letting them in. First Kaya, and now Bilal. I made them a part of me. I housed them like organs. And Babel decided to rip out the pieces I let myself need the most. In those hollow spaces, hate wants in. Hate is already growing. Morning opens the door. She looks exhausted, but one glance in my direction has her crossing the room. She kneels beside me.
"Emmett," she says, "are you okay?"
"I'm fine." She frowns.
"You're not fine, Emmett."
"Really, it's nothing. I'm fine."
"Emmett," she repeats carefully, "you're not fine."
I glance around the room.
For some reason, the whole place looks colorless. Even Morning's face seems like a faded portrait.
"Seriously, I'm good."
I've never seen Morning look so heartbroken.
"You're crying, Emmett."
"I'm okay. I'm not."
"Come here." She sits down on the bed next to me. The only safe place is her arms. I lean that way and let my head fall into her lap. Morning strokes my hair, the way Pops always did for Mom's. It takes about a minute for my senses to come raging back. My eyes are thick with tears.
"They took them from me. Bilal, Kaya, they took them from me."
Morning whispers softly. The graze of her fingertips against my head is the only thing that keeps me from fading to dust. At school, I learned to be tough. I learned that real men only cry at funerals. Friends, and sometimes teachers, taught me to keep my emotions out of life's equations. It was Pops who poked holes in that theory. Sometimes he would cry when Mom's had her bad days. He never apologized for a single tear. Neither will I. Morning holds me. When I close my eyes, Bilal smiles down out of the dark. I can't bear looking at him, though. So I move off into dreams or nightmares, or both. I know I'll have to say goodbye one of these days, but not yet. Not now.
Chapter 4. A Dysfunctional Family. Emmett Atwater. I wake up to raised voices. I reach for Morning, but she's gone. The room's dark. I can't tell if that's because it's night or because I slept through to the next morning. The voices continue to echo down into Hive 3 until I'm on my feet, stumbling toward the sound. Our hive is empty, but in the tunnel,
I spy someone leaning against the wall that connects the underground to the tower. It takes a few seconds to place Katsu's bulky frame. As soon as he spots me, he pushes off the wall and wraps me in an unexpected hug.
"I thought you were going to sleep through your own trial," he says.
"Trial?" I side-eye him. "What trial?"
"Let's just say you've caused some controversy."
Beyond him, two voices volley back and forth. I finally recognize that Morning's is one of them. The other one is Parvin's. She might be a head shorter than Morning, but she's not remotely intimidated. I remember Parvin as a strategical mastermind in the waterway. She and Morning would always consult as they took in a new course. Like Jazzy, she doesn't usually break under pressure. The argument has heat rising along Morning's neck and her cheeks, but Parvin is a perfect picture of calm. She adjusts her Nixian-framed glasses, clearly a parting gift from Babel, before delivering a reply.
"We deserve to know what happened," she says.
"I told you what happened," Morning flings back. "You're just gonna ignore the fact that Babel did this? Seriously? And it wasn't just Amit and Rothi. Anton, Jamie, Alex, they all had to fight. Connect the dots, Parvin. None of them wanted to do this."
As I step out into the light, the entire room goes quiet. Everyone's here. The other squads must have arrived while I was sleeping. And it's pretty clear that they've already taken sides. Anton's spinning a knife in circles on the nearest tabletop with a lazy finger. Golden-curled Alex perches on the same chair. He's tapping out a drummer's rhythm on Anton's shoulder. They look as inseparable as they did up in space. I expected Alex to look more scarred after what Babel put him through, but the relief of being at Anton's side must be keeping the damage at bay. Azima is standing behind Morning in clear support. She's buried her hands in her hips, like she finds this entire argument exhausting. There are three neutral parties, too. Omar looms against one wall. He's the biggest person in the room, but I can see him tapping his arm nervously, like he can't stand the idea of two close friends fighting. Longway and Jazzy sit in front of him, neutral judges of an entertaining tennis match. I almost nod over to them before remembering that the entire room's staring at me, waiting. My accusers stand in support behind Parvin. For some reason, their Nixian masks make them look even angrier. Ida's glare is a cold wind. Noor folds her arms, face full of disapproval within the perfect circle of her hijab. Holly actually cracks her knuckles like we're about to box. But their glares are nothing compared to the sight of Isadora. She stares at me like some horrible queen. I notice that the tight fabric of her suit is stretched. She sets a gentle, protective hand beneath her stomach as she walks forward. The gesture ends me. It's not possible. How is it possible? I think back to the conversation I overheard on the Tower space station. Rothi and Isadora's frustrated argument. It wasn't just an argument between lovers. It was an argument between soon-to-be parents. Parvin steps aside as Isadora takes two strides forward. She's careful to let the entire room see her, see the child she's carrying, as her eyes lock on mine.
"I want to hear you say it. Now that you know what you took from me, Emmett, I want to hear you say it. Tell me you killed him. Say the words."
The accusation strikes like lightning. The following thunder almost drowns out my thoughts. If the room is a storm, we're standing center, clear against the chaos. "They put him in the room with me," I say. "They wanted us to fight. Rothi, he almost killed me. But I left him, Isadora. I used Nixia to seal him in. I left him in that room alive." She hesitates, but only for a second. The brief softness steals over.
"Liar!"
she spits.
"He told me what Babel said. He told me there was only one way out. He promised me he would win, but you're here instead. I know what that means."
Her Nixian sleeve blurs into the shape of a spear. I take an instinctual step back as the substance responds to her anger. Morning slides between us, though. Her own Nixia forms into that deadly pair of hatchets. The rest of the room braces for impact.